In a purely practical sense, it would probably be correct to say that it all began when Sophie Moll came to Imanum. Perhaps it's true that things can change in a day, that a few dozen hours can affect the outcome of whole lifetimes, and that when they do, those few dozen hours, like the salvaged remains of a burned house, the charred clock, the singed photograph, the scorched furniture, must be resurrected from the ruins and examined, preserved, accounted for. Little events, ordinary things, smashed and reconstituted, imbued with new meaning. Suddenly they become the bleached bones of a story. Still, to say that it all began when Sophie Moll came to Imanum is only one way of looking at it. Equally, it could be argued that it actually began thousands of years ago, long before the Marxists came, before the British took Malabar, before the Dutch ascendancy, before Vasco da Gama arrived, before the Zamorin's conquest of Calicut, before three purple-robed Syrian bishops murdered by the Portuguese were found floating in the sea with coiled sea serpents riding on their chests and oysters knotted in their tangled beards. It could be argued that it began long before Christianity arrived in a boat and seeped into Kerala like tea from a tea bag. That it really began in the days when the love laws were made, the laws that lay down who should be loved and how much.
That is great. Thank you very much. Can you explain what the love laws are in your book?
Well, I suppose every society divides itself up into pretty watertight categories. But in India, those categories which are called caste amongst the Hindu population. Caste is an institution which is obviously thousands of years old, and the separation between people is a grotesque and violent one. You know, it's obviously not just that they cannot love each other or marry each other, but caste is something that has decreed what work who should do, and you know, the Brahmin in charge of cleansing the soul, and the untouchable or the Dalit castes in charge of actually cleaning, cleaning filth, cleaning, dealing with every kind of what is considered unpure and polluting work by the caste Hindus.
So if you violate those caste expectations, that caste structure, you will suffer serious consequences.
Well, yes. I mean, even today in Delhi, which is the capital of India, just on the outskirts, you have recurrent instances of even parents murdering in the most brutal ways their own children for marrying outside caste, or whole communities going after young people, beheading them, killing them. And everything, you know, even in the most, in modern India, which is positioned itself as a superpower, caste is the heart of politics. It is the way, even elections are fought and won and lost on the basis of caste. Whatever party you are, whether you're liberal, whether you're the Hindu right wing, and even if you're left wing, caste is at the heart of it all.
Hmm. Now, Arundhati, you seem to occupy a unique place in world literature. You're a celebrated novelist, winner of the Booker Prize in 1998 for The God of Small Things, which became an international sensation. But since then, all of your published writing, as far as I'm aware, has been nonfiction, has been very political. Do you see your work as a novelist and all this other work that you've been doing as an activist as totally different, or are they related in some way?
Well, I have a political essay on why I don't see myself as an activist. You know, I think activist is a very modern term, which somehow seems to reduce both political work as well as literary work, you know. And I think in the olden days, that's what writers did. You know, they did see themselves as people, as commentators on what happens in society. Today, what's happened is that often writers have been embraced by the market in some ways, you know, with a lot of money and a lot of success in those terms. And in some ways, that has been more effective in silencing them and taking them out of the realm of dealing with what really is buffeting society around, you know?
You're saying there's a danger of becoming a celebrated writer, being recognized that way?
No, I think that, what I'm saying is that it's easy for celebrated writers to then keep on trying to produce things that please the market in some ways. And in fact, in what happened in India very soon, I mean, just after my book came out and I won the Booker Prize, it was at a time when India was looking to position itself as this new emerging superpower. And I was claimed not so much for my book as for the prize that I won, as, you know, a person who had been recognized in the international arena. But just then, I think within a few months of the Booker Prize, which had me on the cover of every magazine and so on, the Indian government conducted these nuclear tests. And suddenly there was this horrible, ugly, nationalistic, almost fascist rhetoric, you know. And it was, honestly, it was like suddenly everybody had had a large dose of Viagra or something. And I saw that even artists and writers and actors and everybody was claiming this, these nuclear tests with great pride.
Because this was sort of this moment when India had become a nuclear power, right? I mean, it's sort of this historical moment.
It was. I mean, we had, you know, there had been nuclear tests earlier, but these were linked to some kind of, and it was a right-wing Hindu nationalist government in power. You know, the old, this mosque, the Babri Masjid, had been broken by these mobs, and the Muslim community, which consists of hundreds of millions of people, because it has the largest Muslim population in the world, actually, India, but they were under threat. And all of this, you know, combined to make me feel very, very uncomfortable. And also, since I was on this national stage, I realized that keeping quiet about it was as political as saying anything. So that's when I wrote the first essay called The End of Imagination, you know, which, of course, had people just kick me off the pedestal of being the sort of fairy queen. And then they were like, get out of India and all of that.
So you were no longer the darling of Indian letters.
Just overnight, I was no longer the darling. And I mean, even The God of Small Things, the thing is that, of course, it's a very loved book in India, too. But it's also true that it makes, you know, yesterday I was looking at high school children who had done this whole project here in Madison on the book. And in India, they would not do that, certainly not in Kerala, because it deals with things which people would like to claim the prize, but to kind of elide some of the politics of the book. And it is a book that, you know, you can deal with at many levels. So you could read it and just your eyes just glaze over at the main issues in the book about caste and love, and you can just look at the other things, you know.
So you're saying that, I mean, there are a lot of politics in this novel that you've written, but yet I'm assuming there are also very big differences between what you would do as a novelist. I mean, creating an imaginative work like this and some of your more explicitly political work.
No, there is a big difference, because in the last 10 or 12 years, what has happened is that the political work, the political writing I've done has been urgent and interventionist, you know. So when you see them as collected essays, you know, they have been read over the years because of, you know, the what they are. But they've always been written at a time when I've been trying to sort of blow open a space that's closing in on people. So that urgency, the immediacy of having to intervene is different from fiction, you know, which is more when you need a little more time. And what happens is that because India is a country that's in so much trouble, and from the 90s up to now, it's not easy for me to, you know, once I wrote The End of Imagination, I sort of declared myself as a person who wasn't frightened of being in trouble, or who wasn't frightened of being, you know, not drifting with, you know, the middle class established opinion.
Well, you were attacked on a lot of fronts.
So I was attacked, but I was...
And also, I mean, you've been a very outspoken activist on a number of issues. I mean, you've already mentioned the nuclear testing. You've been a critic of Indian nationalism, of globalization, of a series of big dams being built in India. I mean, you've been out there on a lot of different fronts.
But the thing is that, you know, what happens is that what you hear of is the critique and the anger against me, because those are the people who have a voice. But what you don't see is the embrace, you know. And really, for me, when people keep saying you're controversial, I keep saying, really, you should come and see how which writer would be carried from arm to arm like I am, even in India, you know. And even when The God of Small Things came out in the US, and, you know, it sold more than a million copies in a few years, and then 9/11 happened, and I was very, very upset with, you know, the fact they were preparing to attack Afghanistan. And when I wrote an essay called The Algebra of Infinite Justice, I knew, at least I thought, that, okay, here goes, you know. Until now, I've been this activist who talks about Indian nationalism and dams and so on. But here now, I'm moving into another place, and it's going to be goodbye, America. But I had to do it because I couldn't write otherwise. You know, my veins would be clogged up with my own cowardice or dishonesty. And so I wrote The Algebra of Infinite Justice, and then a series on Iraq and all of that. And yet I found that this was never the case. In fact, it you know, it taught me that even a country like America is not what the government says it is. And there was so much, in fact, that writing on U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. wars made me so many wonderful friends in the U.S. And it teaches you not to look at countries in the ways governments would like you to look at them.
We've talked about a number of the issues that you have been outspoken about, nuclear testing, nationalism, globalization, modern warfare. Is there an underlying set of values for you that brings all of these things together? I mean, is there a vision of society that you are advocating that you think we don't have, we're missing?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just the political essays, but even The God of Small Things. All of it has a very clear way of looking at the world, you know, which for me is very important, because it takes these things and looks at them individually without presenting the world with some huge other big manifesto, you know? Because I think that every decision that is made, every dam that is built, every war that is fought, every kind of new weapon that is offered to the world, there is a different way of doing it, you know? And I think through this writing, that's what I try to say, that look, there's a different way of thinking. There's a different way of being.
A different in what sense? A more democratic way?
Well, I mean, I've written a lot on democracy and how democracy at one time was a threat to this kind of imperial world order, which is why democracies were being toppled in Latin America and Central Asia and Iran and so on. But now wars are being fought presumably in order to install democracies, because democracies have become an instrument of globalization and the free market, you know. So what I'm talking about is really, in the battle between power and powerlessness, how do you resist You know, what are the things you do to resist this hegemonic impulse, which is also natural? I mean, hegemony is something that all governments, all states would strive for. But then the resistance to that is something that is as natural, you know, and how do you strategize? What are the tactics you employ? In India, for instance, there is such a huge bandwidth of resistance against the push of, let's say, these major mining corporations to take over the lands of millions of people. The understanding of really the battle for us is not India versus US or Iraq versus US. Or, I mean, there's no India versus US. They are great allies now. But the real battle is, how do you redefine the meaning of human happiness and fulfillment? How do we learn that what we are fighting for is not making us happy? It's not doing anything for us, neither in the US, nor in India, nor in China.
Is this a critique of, I guess, what you might call the idea of progress in the modern
world? Absolutely. That is at the heart of it. You know, we need to redefine what we mean by progress, what we mean by civilization, what we mean by development. You know, today, the measure of progress is almost synonymous with your levels of consumption, which is psychotic. It's crazy, you know. And you have a situation where we are actually going through a period where I think the major powers in the world are actually psychotic. I mean, you have...
Psychotic.
Psychotic.
I mean, that's a strong word.
Yes, but look at it. I mean, if you look at the wars that have been fought in the last 10 years, you know, countries have been devastated: Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, now Syria, Libya. And the men who started those wars, Dick Cheney says he would do it again in 1 minute. George Bush is painting pictures of himself in the shower. Tony Blair is going around speaking for $500,000 a lecture on ethics and morality and God and love and so on. Isn't it psychotic? It's when they have killed hundreds of thousands of people, when they've destroyed whole countries.
So going back to this idea of a different version of progress, mm-hmm. of what you would call sort of reclaiming what civilization is all about, what is a saner, more livable world than if all of these things that you're talking about are not that way?
Well, if you were to be in India right now, for example, very few people know how violent a country India is. Since 1947, when it became a country, it's had its army deployed within its own territory: Nagaland, Manipur, Mizoram, Kashmir, Punjab, Goa, Hyderabad, the Naxalites, Telangana. There hasn't been a moment in India's modern history where its army hasn't been deployed in its own territory, committing utterly brutal acts. And today, from the edges, the army is going to be deployed in the heart of India, where the forests are, where, you see, in all the wars that, say, were fought in, let's say, the United States, from the time when the native Indians were massacred and finished off, are happening now in the modern world in India. So there's a push to push out indigenous people from the forest, because those forests are where the mineral wealth lies. And you have middle class people actually talking about the fact that, look, every country that has become a superpower has a quote unquote past, and we need to do similar things if we are to get ahead. You know, we can't allow these people to hold us back. And the war really is, to me, about if the world is to change its way of understanding what progress is, we have to first allow ourselves to take sides in this war and say that this nation of indigenous people has to survive. capitalism has to understand that it cannot desecrate every forest, it cannot extract the bauxite from every mountain, it cannot dam every river. And once that understanding sets in, I think the best minds in the world will be working in another direction of how do we manage without this colonial extractive mentality pushing us. I mean, now India and China and the US and everyone's fighting over all these wars that I mentioned. I mean, what happened in Libya? It's really a war between the US and China, you know?
Mm. Well, I want to bring this back to your own personal story. And I guess I'm wondering, as you talk about these various political issues, these problems that are not only in India, but around the world, were you aware of all of this when you were growing up? I mean, were you a political child, or did this only kind of come to you later? I mean, these kinds of concerns.
No, I wasn't a political child in that, you know, I didn't grow up in a family that had a deep or expansive political understanding. And yet, as in the God of Small Things, you know, Kerala was at the time, when I was growing up, it seemed the revolution was just around the corner. And there was a lot of filtered understandings of those things. But politically, I mean, when we ask what is political, obviously, I grew up, on the outside of a very, very traditional community, a very conservative community, a very landed community who looked at us as sort of outcasts and, you know.
Why were you considered an outcast?
Well, because my mother had married outside the community, then was divorced. You know, she didn't have any money and all of that. So you grew up sort of asking yourself questions, you know. It's unorthodox. I mean, I'm not schooled in the normal ways of politics or anything. Much of my political writing is almost trying to explain to myself what's going on. It's not just preaching to other people.
How much of this comes from your perspective growing up as a girl in a traditional community? I mean, it sounds like part of what you're saying is that you didn't want to fulfill the traditional female role that was expected of you.
It was, I mean, I suppose it's hard to answer these things, hard to know. I mean, you can only sort of surmise. And sure, I grew up as a girl in a community where my mother was very, very unorthodox because of what she had been through. So she was not exactly putting pressure on me to be like the other girls, you know. But I was so sure that I wasn't going to, you know, get married to some local boy there with a dowry and all of that. So my mother and I also had a lot of conflict. So I actually ran away from home when I was 16, 17, and I was studying architecture in Delhi. But
So studying architecture, not fiction.
No, I'm an architect. Yeah, yeah.
when did fiction enter your life?
Fiction entered my life long ago, but you know, even when I was a child. But I knew that, at least I thought that I could never ever earn a living, writing. So, I was very desperate to study something where I could support myself financially and never be dependent on anybody and so on. So that's one of the reasons I studied architecture. Then I worked in cinema for a while.
Is there a connection between your architectural background and your fictional writing? Do you sort of bring the imagination of an architect to how you construct a novel?
Absolutely, I do. I think not just a novel, but even all my political writing. I think, you know, the structure is everything in a way. How you tell a story is as important as the story, because, you know, the stories of love and fear and war and terror and childhood, stories have been told, you know. None of us are all that unique, however much we are told that we are great individuals and, you know, all that. We are not, you know, we are part of such a long history of conflict and love and all that. But how you tell a story, how you reveal it, you know, and even in the political writing that I do, I think I don't write as a journalist or as an academic or as a political activist or as a novelist. I think all of those skills are put to use in how you how you unpack something or how you present something or how you look at something, you know?
So you don't really see a sharp distinction between what you do as a novelist and what you do in your more explicitly political writing?
I do. I actually do. I mean, I have in the past said I don't, but when I start, when I'm working on fiction now again after many years, I mean, there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big difference, and that is the difference. I think is the difference of playing. You know, of having the space to play when you're writing fiction. When I'm writing nonfiction, It's like I said, you know, it's an intervention where you're sort of surgically going into a chaotic political situation and saying, look, let's just open this up and say, what the hell are you all talking about? Whereas in fiction, there's so much dance and so much play and so much love and irony. And, you know, in India, for example, when you're writing politically, irony is a real problem because people would just, you know.
Well, why is that a problem in India?
You know, for instance, I'll give you an example. This is not even irony. This is just pure mischief. But I was in Kashmir when there were these huge demonstrations. You know, in Kashmir, there's been a war for self-determination. Kashmir is like India's Palestine.
Mm-hmm. And you have been a strong advocate for the independence of Kashmir.
Yes, yes. So once I wrote this big essay called Azadi, which means freedom. And I was talking about the protests, and I said, one thing that broke my heart when I was in Kashmir was a slogan that said, Nanga Bhuka Hindustan, Jaan Se Pyara Pakistan, which they were chanting, which Nanga Bhuka means naked, hungry India, and Jaan Se Pyara mean dearer than life itself, Pakistan. So I said, what kind of politics is this, and how can you not understand who to align yourself. I had written a whole paragraph about how that was such a reprehensible slogan. And the right-wing Hindu newspapers, the headline was, Arundhati Roy advocates independence for Kashmir from Nanga Bhuka Hindustan, meaning Arundhati Roy says Kashmir should secede from naked, hungry India. Just a complete reversal of what I was saying, you know. And there's so much mischief. There's so much violence. Now there's so much violence, you know. Anything I say or do, right-wing groups have sworn to break up every meeting that I speak at. And, you know, so there's a very, very ugly atmosphere building in India right now.
Does the role of the writer in India, is that different from, say, the role of the writer in the United States? Does the status of a writer in India mean something special?
It depends on the writer. You know, I think what has happened is that there is a kind of ridiculous, you know, I was talking about these mining companies that are blasting their way through the forests in India. Those same companies, sponsor literary festivals and where the big writers arrive and they discuss free speech and so on. But they're actually not addressing, even the issues of how can you allow people who are doing this to sponsor you. So there is a sense in which the Indian government and the Indian elite are using writers to signify, look, we are such a great democracy. Whereas anyone who's actually dealing with real things like Kashmir or Chhattisgarh, where the Maoists are fighting a civil war there, are being deported. I mean, journalists like David Barsamian just deported straight from the airport. Many, many journalists are being threatened, and they're all keeping quiet because they're so worried about being, not David Barsamian, but the rest have been very, very quiet because they hope to come back. And in this way, they are being controlled.
Well, I mean, it just strikes me, I can't think of an American analogy to you. Mm. I mean, to this, you know, the celebrated literary figure, also very outspoken politically. I mean, there certainly are political writers in the United States, but not with the same status that you have. I mean, maybe we used to have those kinds of writers. I don't know. It seems to be, maybe just people don't really pay that much attention to political writers in this country, whereas in India it would seem that you...
No, but even in India it's the same. I mean, most writers are very scared or I don't know for what reason, but even in vernacular languages and in English, they don't engage with what's going on. Because the consequences are, I mean, the consequences are pretty serious. They can be pretty serious, you know.
And you've actually been charged with sedition, for instance.
Sedition. Nowadays, the new tactic is not to... For the state, I mean, they did try once they put me in jail, but then year before last, it was sedition.
And this was because of your advocacy for Kashmir?
Yeah, and interestingly, it was not that the state was charging me with sedition. It was every TV channel going after me, you know, and sort of baying for my blood in some way. But the new thing is to outsource the thuggery. So the state acts as if it's very democratic, but each of these political parties has goons that come out and attack you. I mean, they physically attack you.
And have you been attacked?
I have been attacked. And
What happened?
I was going to, in a place called Bhubaneswar, I was going to speak at a meeting, and these goons sort of just charged me. And then a lot of the time they do it in front of TV cameras, and then all the news is about this. You know, when I was releasing my last book, they jumped on stage and smashed up everything, and you know, that kind of thing. Now they are into very serious, I mean, they attack other people, not just me, but that's the new thing, you know, that you create an atmosphere where people are just terrified, and the state is not doing it. It's the mobs, you know. It's the stormtroopers who are up to all of this, because that's a very clever way of, you know, in public, I mean, internationally, looking like a democratic government, but actually making people very, very scared.
What do you see as what can great literature do to help to create this better world that you've been talking about? Or can it? I mean, is that the job of what literature is about?
Well, I would never be one of those to specify, what the job of literature is. You know, I think literature should be free to do what it wants, you know. So I would not prescribe a role
You would
literature.
Not prescribe a more
never,
political role
never.
In literature.
I would not prescribe any role for literature. But obviously, when I say I don't prescribe a role, I think that all literature is political, even a fairy tale. I mean, no writer can hide behind their words. You know exactly where they're coming from, almost within a paragraph, you know. So literature is as varied as politics or life itself. And there are writers who I think are just, you know, their politics really sucks, but they're beautiful writers, you know, so you can't deny the beauty of that too. And that's fine. You know, I draw inspiration from everything, you know. More, it's not just literature. Like the Kathakali performances in The God of North, you can see how malleable and the fitness of a storyteller to me is an ability to range across, you know, politics, very personal, meaningless things, humorous things, you know, and beautiful things. So in that way, obviously, to me, fiction and the nonfiction are very different. Yesterday, mm-hmm. when I was looking at all the children in the high schools and what they had done with The God of Small Things, I was almost frightened of myself, you know, what did I do? Because you can't be so self-conscious when you write, mm-hmm. and you let it go, and then you see what people make of it. You know, really brought tears to my eyes to see what the children had done.
Now, the first thing that every journalist who writes about you says is, you wrote this amazing book, this novel, The God of Small Things, back in the late 90s. Why haven't you written another novel? Are you working on one?
Yes, I am actually. But when I wrote The God of Small Things, I already knew that there was no way that I was going to write another book very soon, because I don't see myself as some, you know, novel producing factory. I don't see the point of writing, you know, 100 novels. For me, The God of Small Things was something which, you know, had been marinating for a long time. And even now when I write, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious myself to see what I'll write now, because, you know, unlike nonfiction, the fiction surprises me as it comes out, you know. And obviously, I'm not, I'm not a writer who goes and researches a subject and then comes and writes a book about it. Though that's wonderful to do that, but I'm not that, you know. So for me, things need to, you know, the experience and the knowledge and the things I know need to get broken down, and their proteins, and they get assimilated into my body, and then they come out in some way. But even the nonfiction that I've written, even the political writing, it's not that I decide to write about something, then I go and research it. It's almost like you already researched is the wrong word, but just in order not to be humiliated, you already go and find out things, and then there's a point at which the things you know you just can't hold inside you, and you write. But it's not because I want to. I'm not a very ambitious person. I'm not somebody who necessarily, you know, wants to be remembered or wants to be win some big prize or something. I would like to, as I once said, you know, sort of eat mangoes in the moonlight and be a bit irresponsible.
I would love it if we could end with another reading. And one of the themes of your book, The God of Small Things, is the connection between the small things and the big things in life. And there's a passage right at the very end of the book that would you
sure.
be willing to read?
Yeah, of course. An hour later, Amu disengaged herself gently. "I have to go." He said nothing, didn't move. He watched her dress. Only one thing mattered now. They knew that it was all they could ask of each other, the only thing, ever. They both knew that. Even later, on the 13 nights that followed this one, instinctively they stuck to the small things. The big things ever lurked inside. They knew that there was nowhere for them to go. They had nothing, no future. So they stuck to the small things. They laughed at ant bites on each other's bottoms, at clumsy caterpillars sliding off the ends of leaves, at overturned beetles that couldn't right themselves, at the pair of small fish that always sought Velta out in the river and bit him, at a particularly devout praying mantis, at the minute spider who lived in a crack in the wall on the back veranda of the history house and camouflaged himself by covering his body with bits of rubbish, a sliver of wasp wing, part of a cobweb, dust, leaf rot, the empty thorax of a dead bee. Chaputamburan, Velita called him, Lord Rubbish. One night they contributed to his wardrobe a flake of garlic skin and were deeply offended when he rejected it along with the rest of his armor, from which he emerged disgruntled, naked, snot-colored, as though he deplored their taste in clothes. For a few days he remained in this suicidal state of disdainful undress. The rejected shell of garbage stayed standing like an outmoded worldview, an antiquated philosophy. Then it crumbled. Gradually, Chaputamburan acquired a new ensemble. Without admitting it to each other or themselves, they linked their fates, their future, their love, their madness, their hope, their infinite joy to his. They checked on him every night with growing panic as time went by to see if he had survived the day. They fretted over his frailty, his smallness, the adequacy of his camouflage, his seemingly self-destructive pride. They grew to love his eclectic taste, his shambling dignity. They chose him because they knew that they had to put their faith in fragility, stick to smallness. Each time they parted, they extracted only one small promise from each other. Tomorrow, tomorrow. They knew that things could change in a day. They were right about that. They were wrong about Chaputamuran, though. He outlived Velita. He fathered future generations. He died of natural causes. That first night, on the day that Sophie Moll came, Velita watched his lover dress. When she was ready, she squatted, facing him. She touched him lightly with her fingers and left a trail of goosebumps on his skin, like flat chalk on a blackboard, like breeze in a parry field, like jet streaks in a blue church sky. He took her face in his hands and drew it towards his. He closed his eyes and smelled her skin. Amu laughed. She kissed his closed eyes and stood up. Velita, with his back against the mangosteen tree, watched her walk away. She had a dry rose in her hair. She turned to say it once again. Nale, tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.